Hello, everybody. This is your old...
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is your old friend, Blue Otter, coming to you live. And this will be a call-in show. We're going to be talking with my old friend, Jim Pathfinder Ewing. It's been, 9 or 10 years since we spoke to him last. And when he was working pretty closely with the folks at Manitaka. And we've also got our friend Mark the Badger. And he's going to be talking with Jim about his Mayan birthday. And we'll say hello to the folks, Jim.
Howdy, how you doing?
And Osio Ginili Tahiju Tahigu. And let me also say, Gage Yui, you know, on behalf of the people, we love you and everything you do. And Mark's with us, and he's already starting to work out, as I was explaining to Jim, for the last year or more. I don't know how long it's been, a couple of years, I guess. We've been doing Mayan birthday readings for our guests, and it gives you a pretty good idea of what once you've gotten along in life, and then look at this reading, it's kind of an eye opener. It's kind of like, oh, gee whiz, you know, and what they say about the Torah is true. You know, everybody's in the Torah, you know. So, but anyway, what do you see? What do you see, Mark?
Well, his in the traditional Mayan down count, he was born on a day called Tuahau, and that is the second day of the Quak cycle, and that's the glyph of the sun. So a lot of sun energy, and the two is, you know, like most people's thinking, has to do with polarity, energy, positive and negative, and duality and all that, but it, and balance, you know, getting to the balancing. So it has some stuff about the sun and balancing, and so that, I would say that probably comes up a lot in his life. Things like that would probably show up. And his other reading, that's a little bit more where you have the other two time flows coming together. I have three components here, a forward, a backward, and the center or the zero point thing. And on the forward part, he has some energy here that has to do with Venus, planet Venus. And it's having things to do about with art, and the sun energy again is coming back in here too, that provides energies of life and things having to do with power of courage and transmuting things, changing things, and service. So I would say that, you know, he's probably had a general path in his life of kind of things about serving, doing things, helping others, trying to buy and bind it in with things that are kind of artistic, creative, but also aspects of power of graces and beauty, things like that, to change things, basically transmutation or changing things. On the opposite flow of time, coming back from a next cycle into our cycle, he has energy that has to do with birthing things, teaching things, especially things that have to do with nurturing, belonging to things, natural ways, things with communities and cooperation of things. A lot of things, I would say, probably in the last, you know, I don't know, 5, 10, 14 years of maybe of that type of nature. Also things with movement and thought, movement of energy and thoughts and intentions and synchronicities of things. So he's probably been working or seeing more of those types of things showing up maybe in his life too, and helping and combining with the other things we just mentioned a minute ago about the service and transmutation. Where these two come together and create a zero point or a movement or a bridge or a doorway between the worlds, he has things that have to do with expanding and growth of the soul, things that have to do with joy, forgiveness, a lot to do with light. This probably goes in with the synchronicity movement and thought we were talking about before and energy, because it'd be a not just light, but a radial or spiraling light. And usually you'll probably see one of them going one way and the other one going the other way, so counter-rotational light. And this will mix in with, he'll can have the opportunity of using this in for a purpose with some discipline and will to use that. So it's a combination of light, purpose, discipline, will, and using that conjunction with soul energy. So he may have been seeing some of that showing up a lot in his life, too. That one is coupled with the color green, which would be what was coming out of the frequency that comes out of the top of a pyramid. Does that make sense? I went through that pretty quick.
Sounds good to me. yeah, I see that as... I'm familiar with some of that at from the Mayan calendar, is that two as being choices. That's at least the way I see it, is that seeing choices and things and being forced to be mindful of balance and seeing both sides. Because I found that throughout my life that when I go off in one direction without paying attention to the other, that's when I get in trouble. So, being mindful of balance, keep. I'm one of these people. It's kind of like I like to go charging off, I get in causes or I get things fire me up. I get excited about things. So. I go forward and sometimes I go without being mindful enough of what I'm doing. My zeal is carrying me too far forward.
They call that being quixotic. Tilting at windmills. I'm the same way.
Yeah.
I'm the same way.
So,
hey, let me ask you a question. What Old Testament story do you identify with the most?
Gosh, I think the burning bush is probably the one, seeing Creator in a fire and trying to do the will of Creator and being forced to make choices that are very difficult, and sometimes they aren't logical. I think that's one that resonates with me.
Well, you have the gift of dreams?
Oh, absolutely.
Obviously, yeah. Well, you were born during the portion of the Old Testament, Genesis 41:1 through 44:17. This is where Joseph had the dream about the seven. There's going to be... where Joseph was in prison and Pharaoh had the dream and then he wanted somebody to interpret it and correspondingly that's called a Torah portion. You also have a what's called a Haftarah about Solomon, 1 Kings 13:15. Excuse me, 1 Kings 3:15 through 3:28, where Solomon awoke out of a dream. And yeah, because I noticed, two of your books had dream, and I'll send you a copy of where you can go to read this. And this is kind of interesting. just they're just little hints, I think, that Creator provides, you know, so you can so you know you're not lost and you're on the right track. But sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, that's very interesting. And I'd say that that's probably a very apt parable or story that would be connected with me, not do anything I've, you know, had a will or intent to do, but just the way things have always been. I wrote about in one of my books, Healing Plants and Animals from a Distance, Curative Principles and Applications, about how when I was very young that I had this ability to dream the future. And it was more of a curse because, of course, I was very young, and I would tell people what I saw, and then they wouldn't believe me and would just laugh. And then when it happened, then they'd get angry at me like it was my fault. And so it was a gift, I guess, if you want to call it, that I didn't much care for, particularly when they were very scary and I couldn't comprehend them. Some of them I didn't know what they meant until many years later when I realized what they were. You know, as a child, you don't know what a lot of things are, and you see things which you don't understand. And then later on, I remembered, you know, some of these dreams and what they were and so forth. But that's something that I always had. It was something that also, as I've written about in some of my books too, when I was younger, I don't have it much anymore today, but when I was younger, I could also read people's minds, and it wasn't something that I consciously did. It was more, and particularly on the telephone, where I would answer a question and the person had not verbalized it. They were just thinking the question. And that was very embarrassing when I was a teenager, you know, when you're calling up a girl wanting to ask for a date or something, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so you had deep discernment.
Those are some of the things that have occurred long ago anyway.
So you had the gift of deep discernment. Yeah, you were, yeah, when I saw that, I was going, oh my gosh, he's got the gift like Joseph had, and which put him in a position eventually becoming second only to Pharaoh, and he literally saved the, you know, the that saved Egypt and Israel from destruction. The entire area was under 7 years of famine. So tell us. Now,
I think that all of us have this ability to varying degrees, but we're not taught how to access them. And when I was a young man, I had the opportunity to apprentice to a Cherokee medicine man, but I was at that time I was really too dumb or whatever to do it, and so. I had other things on my mind, but I did learn a little bit from him. And one of the things was that he impressed upon me was the apprehension of reality, and that is that we perceive things the way we're taught. And you may be aware that in the olden days, back when Cherokee people, before European expansion, you know, when an apprentice was brought to, you know, a priest, that his mind was wiped clean so that he could learn anew how to perceive reality. We don't do those things today. But as I've written in one of my other books, Dreams of the Reiki Shaman, it was learning to apprehend reality in a broader way can open you up to what some of my teachers have called your spirit eyes. And that is being able to see things not with your physical eyes, but from spirit, so that you're seeing what some people call non-ordinary reality. And everyone can do that, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think some of us are wired a little bit better for it, but it's up to us to help teach those who aren't. Because I know my first wife was my teacher, and I had a latent gift, and you know, from my mother, and but Joanne really brought it out in me.
Yeah, well, you know, our partners, our life partners, are reflections of us, and they reflect back to us areas in which we can use some growth. So she was reflecting to you things that you had that perhaps you didn't know you had, and that's the role of a good partner.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well,
I can't believe it's been 10 years since we've talked. That's amazing. That's astounding.
Nine or ten.
When I heard your voice, it sounded like we're just continuing the conversation we had 10 years.
Yeah, I know. And I got your book, and it was an interesting read. It's been about a year since I read it. Why don't you bring us up to date on your newest book, and then whatever time we got left, tell folks about your other books.
Okay. It's called Conscious Food, Sustainable Growing and Spiritual Eating. And, of course, everybody has to make a living, and I'm very happy and pleased and privileged to have the opportunity to teach people how to grow in a sustainable manner, that is, with non-chemical farming. And I've had a organic farm up until this year. I moved to the city. Might say I sort of retired from farming, but I had a small organic farm. And this book was arose from it, and of course also from my previous books. And would it be okay if I read a little bit from?
Oh
from
yeah,
the book?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, this is just 2 pages, but I hope that's not too much. But I think
this is your show, man. Go for it.
Okay, give you a pretty good idea. When the first Europeans came to the Americas, they were amazed at the park-like qualities of the forests. Native Americans routinely practiced controlled burning to keep brush down and to reduce wildfires from deadwood that would destroy villages and food sources. They kept meadows and fields open by burning as well, but they didn't slash and burn as did Europeans. Rather, they used a process called slash and char. That is, early Americans didn't completely burn the vegetable matter, but scorched it to make charcoal and then stirred it into the soil, creating what's called terra preta throughout the Americas. In this process, they used low-intensity fires, reportedly so cool they could be walked through. They would improve the soil and make more efficient use of the carbon in the plants. As a result of this carefully cultivated low biomass fire making, the soil was left with more plant-available phosphorus, calcium, sulfur, and nitrogen than commonly found, often with rich, black, fertile soil, layer upon layer, 6 feet deep. They also worked in turtle, fish, and animal bones as a compost from their food. Organic matter sticks to charcoal rather than being washed away or attaching to other compounds, so that over time it partly oxidizes for nutrients to bind to, providing persistent fertility. In addition, the process doesn't release much carbon into the atmosphere, a cause of climate change, a lesson the modern world should heed. In the scientific way of viewing the world, employing biochar with crops is typically seen as an input or simply an agricultural practice. But as we have seen with the belief systems of agricultural peoples throughout time, from prehistoric peoples to the Essenes to the Gnostics, to the Native Americans, agricultural practices are not seen as separate mechanical activities, but as outgrowths of a spiritual belief system and an interaction with the soil as a living being, an essential part of the community of itself. In this view of the world, a corn kernel is not a seed, but a relative entrusted to the people. It exists not only in this time, but in all time, as a gift from immortal beings, from the time before time to the present, so that humans might survive and thrive through eternity. The elders of the communities were taught to respect the life within them and around them, and to make sure all decisions regarding the community were considered for their impact upon the future generations. Thus, continuity of the social system was maintained in harmony with the seeds and plants that provided food for the people. The artifacts that are found composted into the soil where ancient peoples live, turtle, fish, and animal bones, were not rationalized soil amendments, but gifts back to the Earth Mother. The animals came from Earth and were reverently returned to Earth so that the sacred hoop of life could be made complete. Enriching the soil was the result of reverence and respect and the spiritual obligation of humankind. The modern world seems mostly oblivious to its role in the sacred hoop of life, its duty to give back what has been taken, so that the circle can remain unbroken and cycle of abundance of life for all beings. Taking without giving is a trait that impoverishes soil as well as individual human worth, dignity, integrity, and social systems. The production of biochar by indigenous peoples was a spiritual activity that defined the synergistic relationships among individual humans, their societies, the plant and animal nations that fed them, and their responsibility to Earth in replenishing growing systems so all could live and thrive. I think that pretty well sums up in microcosm the book, in that showing that we live in a system where everything is science or is objective and away from us. But the natural way of being among Native peoples and actually among indigenous peoples around the world in previous times was that our food and earth, our lives, our bodies were all of one piece, and that to try to take one away is to make us incomplete. We know now that we have a yearning for this thing, a hunger, if you will, for a whole life, a holistic life, where spirit infuses everything we do. And we recognize that intuitively, but our society constantly holds it away from us. And so we have a lot of division and strife.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Exactly.
Part of your Senate words that you read reminded me, because my wife and I do gardening, and just something that cropped up on one time just out of the blue for me was just I started saying, well, I made a deal with the plants. You know, I said, well, you know, you take care of me and feed me and stuff, and we'll harvest the seeds, and we'll take care of your children and make sure they're taken care of and that. So we kind of make an agreement like that, you know, where people can start to learn to have, you know, the kind of relationship that your book is talking about.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, when they get to growing, they either overcome that arms-linked relationship. If you stay at that arms-linked relationship, I don't think you get the full heart-centered activity that gardening is such a provides.
Absolutely. Yeah, and, you know, just so people don't think that this is that this idea only come from the liberal side of the aisle. You know, President Reagan said in a speech in 1983, he says, "We hear so much about the greed of business. Well, frankly, we have to hear a little more about the courage, generosity, and creativity of business. I'd like to hear it pointed out that entrepreneurs don't have guaranteed annual incomes. Before they can turn a profit, they must anticipate and deliver what consumers want. The truth is, before entrepreneurs can take, they must give." And, you know, we hear, yeah, you know, we hear a lot, you know, from, you know, people on the left side of the aisle, you know, pointing the finger at the people on the right side, but we don't listen to each other anymore. And we don't even accurately report what the other guys are saying, you know, so, and which is really unfortunate because, you know, this happened with Governor Huckabee this week, a perfect example. He said something about women, and then it was reported, you know, two different places, the exact opposite of what he said. And that was really interesting. But anyway, yeah, go ahead and listen. If you ever, you know, we may have some live listeners, and if you want me to watch for callers and just, you know, break in for a question, let me know if that's okay.
Sure. Fine.
Okay. Okay. So we'll open up the number to call is 347-996-3318. It's right on the screen in front of you that you're listening, and you can also Skype in by using your headset. And there's a little blue button right there on the screen. But yeah, go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Well, you know, talking about what you're relating is because we don't have the discourse that that Native people had. You know, it's well known that that the American democracy was patterned on that of the Iroquois, who had a working system of democracy. And in that way, and of course I note this in my book, that they, along with most Eastern tribes, were matrilineal. The property owners were women, clans, you know, the clan heads. But they would have, and other tribes too, would have, when they would have disagreements or so forth, they would hold convocations where people would discuss the issues and ideas and come to an agreement. And frequently what would happen is that a clan mother, for example, would choose someone, a male usually, who was articulate and could represent that clan. And then in the discussions, he would give those talks, and other people would give their talks. And sometimes these discussions could go on for many days, and until they were all in agreement. Frequently, this was something that was taken regarding war and peace, and that was one thing that the early French, who recorded these things, said that the Iroquois were considered extremely fierce in battle because they would discuss whether they were going to go to war until everyone was in agreement, every man, woman, and child. And then when that decision was made, it wasn't just sending men off to war. It was a commitment of the entire people, and they would fight until they were literally dead. So that was something that we don't hear a lot about, but that's real democracy for sure.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, we know now because astronomers are actually able to dial back the universe that, I can't remember the exact, but there was an eclipse right at that time when the Peacemaker came, and I saw a History Channel program about the Hiawatha and the Great Lawn. They pretty much pinpointed the year, and it was right around 921 AD, I want to say, something like that. So it's been almost 1,100 years. And oddly enough, the same type of government sprouted up in Iceland at the same time. It's not known, but it's a representative democracy, you know, Republican style, Republic kind of government. And, you know, the Europeans laughed. They called it a petticoat government at that time. But Benjamin Franklin and others that were involved in the Albany Compact really saw the merit of it. But there was quite a bit of discussion about it in the newspapers, I believe, in this, I want to say the 1740s or 50s. And so some of those ideas, you know, got into our Constitution. But they weren't ready for...
It's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to research. And some of the, if you look into it, you see also that some of these stories we've been handed down in our culture about the savages and so forth, and about settlers, women settlers being kidnapped. Actually, the women went over to the native side because they had more rights.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely right. Yeah, that was. Yeah, my teacher Roll Thunder back during the Dawes enrollment period. That's how his grandfather met his grandmother. There was a Cherokee that was paid to sweep up the enrollment office, and he saw money changing hands, white people getting the roll. So he stole the evidence and showed it to the traditionals. And there was a resistance movement called SNCC, and they swept down south, even down into Texas. They went at every homestead, and they fire a shot through the door, and they shoot the chimney down. This one place, there was an old woman that came to the door, and a beautiful young girl, and behind her, and Roland Thunder's grandfather arranged to have her abducted, and she was explained that she was told that, you know, they were going to keep her there for a year, and if she wanted to stay after that, you know, she could stay or go, and she opted to stay, and only after that did Rolling Thunder's grandfather profess his love for her, and they together. From what I understand, when the slave market in New Orleans, when they knew the Cherokee coming to buy slaves, boy, they really perked up because the Cherokees worked right in the fields with their slaves. I'm sure there are exceptions, but they were treated a lot better. Anyway, so yeah, go ahead and I always say I don't like to interrupt, but I always end up talking people's legs off.
There's a lot of history there that isn't recorded or isn't handed down. Do you want me to read a little bit more from my
go
book?
For it. You betcha. Go ahead.
Okay. Let's see here.
Oh, and while you're looking for that, I saw a National Geographic program about what you're describing. The Indians in the Amazon actually created islands, actually created land this way. They would burn, and after a while, you know, after they built up a certain number of layers, then they would farm it. And it was this was discovered not too long ago, and when they researched, they found out that it was an actual living thing. This annual burning, you know, low intensity burning would create the islands that were actually teeming with life under the soil.
Yeah, well, a lot of scientists are finding that a lot of what we consider to be a living Earth is in fact true. That not only does the soil have millions of microorganisms, but it also through root systems and so forth, has a form of sentience. It's believed that before there was any type of human disruption of the soil, that there very well could have been a type of sentience, like not unlike, you know, that movie of a few years ago with I'm sure you're familiar with it, the one, I forget the name of it, the with, what was it, Pangea was the you know, the one I'm talking about. But the thing is that I'm not against science by any means, but we're a little bit slow sometimes on our ability to measure and determine things that we know intuitively. In my book, I have I talk about biocultural evolution, about how agriculture and actually the selection of food changed human beings. And that is that, and I give several examples but of what biocultural evolution is, but one is that when early human beings, they ate certain, the ability to think and to speak allowed them, and for a longer adolescence of children, allowed them to transmit knowledge, so that that when they picked foods that were nutritious, they could tell one another and that this was a good, nutritious food. And so by eating good, nutritious food and being able to hand that down, what that did was it created human beings with larger brains and greater ability to transmit knowledge and speak. And so we became, you know, that was one of the factors that so we became able to converse and have civilization and so forth. And so that interaction with the environment is called a biocultural evolution. In other words, we, and different other examples are that we, by choosing plants that are nutritious and so forth, we plant more of them. And so we change the world and we change ourselves. And so it's a synergy. What I point out in my book is that, well, let me just read two paragraphs here that goes from that. It says, we are at a crossroads. The dehumanizing of food, which includes its spiritual aspects, is having unintended consequences, including burgeoning populations with food allergies and obesity, greater scarcity of arable land from which to produce food, and ever fewer food species from which to derive nutrients. It is a biocultural nightmare that began with the first significant biocultural revolution during the Paleolithic era, the introduction of agriculture. And it requires a new start, a second biocultural revolution, one involving new food choices that will allow us to re-envision agriculture as healthful and sustainable, and thereby change our culture, our genetic makeup, and our world. And what that means is that what's happening now is that through, once again, unintended consequences, which is a type of modern industrial agriculture, which is destroying our world and creating artificial food sources like GMOs and food products that are killing us through obesity, hypertension, various food allergies, and so forth. In other words, food that's not good, food that's not healthy, then, you know, we're actually, biocultural evolution is continuing, but it's continuing down the wrong path. And it's believed that this generation may actually, because of all these things, because of obesity and food, food-related illnesses and so forth, may have a shorter lifespan than their parents, reversing hundreds of years of trends of greater health, nutrition, and longevity, and because of this of where we are. And so what I call for in my book, instead of biocultural evolution, is biocultural revolution, and that is to make choices for healthful foods. And by doing so, and you know, by buying locally, by buying organic or sustainable, nutritious foods, we can actually change ourselves and our world. We can change this this trend that's going on and make it so that we are back on the right path.
Exactly. You know, I didn't realize it, but you and I were describing the same thing. I just had to get on Google. Yeah, it's the Terra Preta. You can Google T-E-R-A space P-R-E-T-A. And, you know, when I was in Missouri, I was told that the Cherokees, up until fairly recently, the custom was to come home after, you know, Easter Sunday. And that was the time they burn off the yard. And that would kill the ticks and the chiggers. But this is the process that was used to create Mexico City. It was originally a lake, and they built floating they had a system where they would create floating islands that eventually became soil, and this stuff's been known to regenerate itself about a centimeter a year, and it's compost the way it's done, but it's got high charcoal content, and it was fascinating. I didn't realize how they did it, but yeah, Terra Preta is a Portuguese term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you yeah, go ahead, and you know, if you want to get into any of your other books, you know, this is This your chance to hawk your wares, you know. I'm hoping you'll post this interview on your website, and people can listen to you. You know, when they hit the page, you know, it'll start still playing. But yeah, please do continue.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm kind of focused on this book now because that's where I'm at right now. You know, I started mm-hmm. writing these books. You know, when we talked 10 years ago, mm-hmm. I had actually written the first book and was looking for a publisher. And it took 2 years before it was picked up. But that was Clearing, A Guide to Liberating Energies Trapped in Buildings and Lands. That came out in 2006. That was my first book. I should say it's my first published book, in that I actually wrote one before that, which was kind of could be titled "More Than Anyone Would Ever Want to Know About Energy Medicine," which was kind of everything I'd sort of learned over the years, and so I sort of crammed it all together, and I had this sort of massive tome that was that, you know, I thought was pretty good, and but I couldn't find anybody who wanted to print it, and so I took it to a lady who was a expert. She was a book editor from New York, and I had to pay her to read it, and she read it and critiqued it and said basically that nobody would ever read it because it was just too much and it wasn't designed very well and so forth. And so anyway, I hired her and to help me craft a book out of it. And it got so tedious and bogged down that I gave up on it. And so she called me up one day, about a year later, and she said, what are you up to? And I guess this is about a year before you and I talked. This was like in 2003. And she said, what are you up to? And I said, well, you know, how's the book going? She said, well, I kind of gave up on it. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, it just got bogged down. I couldn't do it. And she said, well, what are you up to these days? And so back then, you know, I was doing a lot of ceremony. And so, and one of the things I was doing was clearing, you know, land and places and buildings and, you know, what houses and whatever. And so, you know, I told her about it. She said, why do you think there's a book in that? And I said, well, possibly, you know. And she said, well, if so, what would it be? I said, well, I think most of what I do, anybody could do. It would be a book on, you know, how to clear your own house or land, property, whatever, energetically and spiritually. And she said, okay. So so I wrote it, and it took a week to write. That was night and day. And I got fired up, like we were talking about earlier, and wrote it in a week. And then it took 2 years for me to edit it and re-edit it and re-edit it, and then finally for a publisher to pick it up. But that was my first book.
Yeah. Outstanding.
And it's still out there. It's been in multiple editions. It's been published in English, French, German, Russian, and Japanese.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Available on that. It's still selling.
And it's available on Amazon, no doubt.
Oh, yeah, it's on Amazon. It's called Clearing.
So if people put in Clearing and your last name, Ewing, E-W-E-I-N-G, they'd find it.
Right, yeah.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I just did an upgrade for my e-books in the process. I got the first one done, second one written, and we got those up on Amazon right after Christmas, and... I'm also going to do their, you know, in case somebody's crazy enough to want a, you know, 300 pages, you know, in print. And you know, I actually had a couple people, you know, when I first wrote them that, because they're encyclopedias. There's an introduction that I got in the Encyclopedia of the Eastern Prophecies of the Eastern Hemisphere from, you know, all kinds of, you know, including indigenous people and, you know, people of the book and, and then I did one of the Western Hemisphere, and it was 1,000. The four books together is 1,000 pages, but it's they're more of a research tool than anything else. And so I know what you mean about mine. Really should be edited a lot more, but I just slapped them together as compilations, and really could add quite a bit more because I run across more. But anyway, yeah. So I feel you. not an easy process.
Yeah. And then my second book was kind of grew out of that. It's called Finding Sanctuary in Nature: Simple Ceremonies in the Native American Tradition for Healing Yourself and Others. And you know, you probably remember back then I traveled a lot.
Uh-huh.
Did a lot of ceremony. I went all over the country, you know, from California to Florida, Northeast, you know, a lot of travel in Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. Involved with the Southern Cherokee in Texas and so forth. And, so, you know, I wrote that book, which was, you know, not giving away any secrets, really, but to give simple ways that people could bring into their lives ways of bringing balance and healing and so forth. And it's been a pretty popular book. It's done quite well. Anyway, now I've got six books, and they just kind of one after the other.
And people actually buy them. That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
And so say you moved off your farm now. Where are you living now, Mississippi still?
Yeah, I'm still in Mississippi, but I live in town now. I live in a little small town, you know, not too far from where I used to live. But
what county?
To things. in Rankin County.
Oh, really? Yeah. See, my mother grew up in Vicksburg.
Okay. Well, that's in Warren County, which is
yep.
about an hour
yep.
and a half, maybe, from here. Yeah.
And you're south, Rankin south of Vicksburg, isn't it?
No, it's in the central part of the state. It's
essentially
a suburb of Jackson.
Oh, Jackson. Yeah, yeah. I thought I'd run across it. I just couldn't remember when. So, yeah, we were through there a year ago, and so I remembered. Yeah, Rankin. Okay. So, yeah, my uncle lives in Brandon. He used to work for
just down the road.
WJTV.
Just down the road.
Charles Hendricks is his name. And, so anyway, yeah, go ahead and continue. I broke my promise that I keep interrupting you. Back then, you were doing quite a bit of work with Monotaca. And, I got Grandfather Lee what's his name? The Lakota elder. Just brain fart, slipped my
Will
mind.
Blazer.
Yeah, Will
Blazer.
Yeah, I had them on last year.
Yeah.
And he's doing quite a bit better. He was down in your, you know, part of the country, what, about 5-6 years ago, was very badly beaten. And
that was about 7 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Time flies.
Yeah, he could have been killed.
Yeah.
So, and you're into Reiki also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that was in 1992. I was deer hunting and was in a deer stand and fell. And was getting out of the deer stand, and I'd put my hand on a limb, and it broke, and I went tumbling 20 feet down and shattered my left leg. And didn't know whether I was going to keep my leg or not. You know, it was 50-50. And when they put me under the knife and had to sign a paper that it was okay for them to take off my leg. But when I woke up, I still had my leg, but they had put it together with a steel plate and 19 pins and so forth. And basically, I'd said I'd never be walk normally again. And I was in a wheelchair for a long time, had learned how to walk all over again and stuff, but it was a pretty bad way. But, and then it was painful. It was, it wasn't a question of if there was pain, it was how much pain. Some people would say, well, that's a pretty bad thing. And I'd say, well, actually, though, it turned out pretty good because even though it was probably one of the worst things ever happened in my life, it put me on the healing path.
Uh-huh.
And one of those things was that I was actually at a conference on shamanism in Wisconsin. And And my leg was hurting me, and I told the person I was with, I said, man, my leg is really hurting. And a lady behind me leaned forward, and she whispered, says, I overheard you saying, excuse me, but I'm a Reiki master. If you'd like, I'd be happy to help you during the break. And I said, okay. Well, I'd never heard of Reiki. I didn't know what it was or anything like that, but I figured, why not? You know, if it doesn't, couldn't hurt. And so during the break, we went in this room, and this lady had me lie down there, and she, what appeared to me, waved her hands over my leg, and voila, the pain went away. And I told her, now mind you, I'd had constant chronic pain for years, and it was the doctors had told me that really I needed an artificial joint in my ankle that I had what's called tertiary arthritis where the bones are rubbing against each other and extremely painful. But the science wasn't there yet for them to put a joint in there, artificial joint. So for the pain to go away was a miracle, literally a miracle. And I told the lady, I said, ma'am, I don't know what you did, but I've got to learn how to do that. And so, you know, I got back and I started looking for somebody who knew Reiki, and I found a Reiki master, a lady in Jackson, who, you know, worked on me and showed me how to do it. And I got into him and so forth. And so then I started learning everything I could about it, and I went and I studied with William Lee Rand and International Center for Reiki Training. And this was just added to what I was already doing. And mind you, I you know, already had a lifetime of a type of medicine, spirit medicine, which was arising from, you know, my childhood and youth and so forth, and what some, you know, would you would call shamanism or whatever, and visioning or however you want to call it. And so, you know, I came at this, you know, I learned Reiki from this experience. And so for me, it was to, you know, incorporate in this Reiki, which is a Japanese hands-on form of healing, to what I already knew. And so what, and particularly with, you know, my native teachers, you know, people who had taught me things. And so so what resulted was what I call Reiki shamanism. And so that was my fourth book was called Reiki Shamanism, and a guide to out of body healing, and so that's what that was about.
Uh-huh.
And it's not it's Reiki. I mean, it's Reiki, but it also incorporates a lot of other things too.
Yeah, I got my level one. I went in 91 or 2, and one of the things they taught us was that some people have natural Reiki, and I've been able to do, even though I didn't get the level 2, I've been able to, they don't get into long-distance healing until, what, level 3?
No, you can do it at level 2.
At 2, yeah, I never got the level 2 at 2, but I have been able to do it.
Well, let me tell you something about energy medicine, because one of the things that you know, I've learned a lot of different methods of what is called energy medicine or spirit medicine or whatever, you know, different names. And essentially they're all the same, they just have different names for the things that they do. And for example, in Reiki, if you remove let's say in shamanism, just about shamans everywhere remove negative things that may be found in the spirit body, and so you just reach in and pull them out. And so is in shamanism would be called removing a spiritual intrusion. Okay, but in Reiki, that would be called psychic surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same thing. So, and Reiki itself, a lot of people, you know, there's dogmatic people in every form of spirit medicine, energy medicine, whatever you want to call it. And a lot of Reiki people really resent anybody who doesn't do it the way they think is right, which is a very narrow way of looking at Reiki. If you, and that's why I've written two books on it, showing that actually Reiki is a form of shamanism, and that Dr. Asui, who originated Reiki, actually the symbol that is used that says Reiki in Japanese literally means shaman who makes rain, okay? And what that means is that he creates something from nothing, okay? He creates and in the kanji, the actual caricature character of Reiki, what is the word Reiki in Japanese, shows a mist, and it shows a symbol of the people receiving this, and it comes down as rain. So what he's doing is creating a positive physical benefit from something that is mist or spirit form, you see. So that symbol in the center there, which is, you know, it could be, it can be interpreted as the shaman, as the shaman who brings rain. Even in the on the master symbol of shamanism, central to it is called, in that kanji, that character, that Japanese character, is called the fire carrier, okay? And the fire carrier actually is the heart. In other words, it is the heart that gives you balance. And this fire carrier, which is has a symbol above it, which is of spirit, or the superman or ober spirit, or higher power, is above it, and then below it are symbols for the sun and moon. So the fire carrier is walking upon the sun and moon with spirit above, the potential to be a greater person above. And so what you've got there also is that the master symbol, which a Reiki master has as a guide or can be used as a meditation for following the path of being a Reiki master, actually is again a symbol of one who is walking the shamanic path. So what I'm showing in this book, Reiki Shamanism, which also has been translated in all those languages in multiple editions, is that in different parts of the world, in different cultures, we have the same teachings being taught again and again and again, but within different cultural contexts. So what you say about that everyone has a Reiki ability or without Reiki is true in this way, in that how did Dr. Usui come up with these symbols? Well, they came because he went on a fast, like we, you and I, would call a pipe fast or a vision quest, okay? And he went out and he stayed out there for 21 days at a mountain, which was a place, a sacred spot, until he had this vision, you know, or cry, you know, like we would cry for a vision. In Native way, we'd cry for a vision. Go to a sacred spot. We'll go to a sacred mountain, or maybe we go to a forest, or maybe in the old Cherokee way, we'd create a sacred fire and have that fire speak to us, you know. But it would be in one of those ways where we would see and vision and be inspired, in other words, have spirit enter our bodies to have a way of vision and perhaps symbols of this new knowledge that Creator gives to us. And so that is a way in which different peoples around the world are very similar, or were very similar, in indigenous peoples around the world before the modern era.
Fascinating. As I recall, he got the attunement symbols came to him in what looked like bubbles, didn't they?
Well, I don't really recall that part, but
yeah, mixing him up with Gordon Michael Scallion, I don't know.
Okay, but the symbols are actually well known, and as Buddhist, and and have been known for their healing power, but were not used because it was considered to interfere with a person's karma.
Uh-huh.
And in my classes, I teach Reiki Shamanism classes. As a matter of fact, I'm going to teach, I will be teaching, I don't teach them very often now. I just teach like now, I'm teaching just twice a year. My next one is going to be in Maui in May. And so you can look on my website, blueskywaters.com. And it's not up yet. I haven't put it up yet, but I'll be teaching a class on Reiki Shamanism in Hawaii.
Oh, that's cool. Maui. I've got the Akalva Native American Church. We've got a branch on Maui. And I've got
very
some
cool
other friends that are on Maui. And Oh, excellent, excellent. Yeah, you know, right after we got our attunement, well, when I was 16, I had my wisdom teeth removed. And then when I was about, I don't know, 30-ish or so, I had some bone chips started to work their way out of my gums. And it was quite painful. And, so Joanne said, well, let me do Reiki on it. And so I just laid back, and it felt like she was actually tapping on my face. And I said, you're tapping on my face. She says, no, I'm not. And she actually picked her hand up a little bit and allowed me to slide my hand up underneath to prove that, you know, she wasn't tapping on my face. But it was amazing. And then we used to get out and visit my friend Robert Three Eagles. His wife was a therapeutic touch practitioner. And, of course, she had some autoimmune problems. So she and Joanne would lay on the bed and they'd grab each other's feet and, you know, head to feet, you know, with their heads at opposite. And they would close their eyes and they became aware of places in when they were working on Robert's wife Amanda, that she'd get to a certain place where the energy would run around in a circle. It would be like almost like a hammer, and it would bang against this place and keep bang, 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 and it would cycle until it would break through that blockage, and it would move on to the next blockage. And they do that for several hours, and she had wonderful therapeutic benefit from that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great system. I use it every once in a while when my wife's got fibromyalgia. I've been widowed twice, but my wife Linda has fibro, and I used it quite a bit when we first got together. And we've been doing some other healing intervention things with. But yeah, Reiki, I can't recommend it. It's fantastic. It really is. And anybody can do it.
Well, I'm literally a walking example of the healing power of Reiki, because my leg's fine now and I don't have any problems, and I didn't have to get an artificial ankle, and I actually have run in some 5Ks.
So, oh wow!
You know, yeah. So,
oh my word!
And I bicycle and I do all kinds of things, but so I tell people in my classes and my that you know. I'm literally a walking example of it.
Oh, yeah. If anybody wants to call in, we're up for about another half hour. The number is 347-996-3318. And, yeah, we usually get, you know, a few live listeners, but this show, will, before it's all done with in the next couple months, will probably have 1,000 listeners. And, but yes, it's good getting together with you again, and I've got all your old pictures of you drumming when you were on the road. I still have had those.
Yeah.
Up.
Well, I've gained a little weight since then.
Uh-huh.
I'm not that svelte guy anymore. Svelte young guy. A little grayer and a little heavier and. Whatnot. I think a little wiser, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way it goes. Yeah, I hadn't been home to Vicksburg for many, many years, and I passed through there in the spring of 2010, just a couple times, and then last February when Linda and I went down to meet Charles. got Flohi Rogers. He's the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation of Mexico, and he's a classically trained MD and has a cancer clinic in Mexico. We spent a few days with him, and since that trip, Linda's health has just improved by leaps and bounds, and mine too. And then we discovered Protandim back in July, and my energy level's way up, right away, 440 pounds. And I'm getting ready to, and I've, for years, you know, I'm the kind of person I'll take care of everybody else first. And I've been doing that for a long time. And, but, you know, doing what I do, I sit a lot. And, you know, I'm recognizing that at this point I need to do, I did oral chelation about 10 years ago. I'm going to do it again. But I want a treadmill. Because when you get as big as I am, you know, you can walk, but, you know, if you hit even a little rock, you know, it causes, you know, havoc with your ankles. And I discovered that the treadmill market has caught up with the reality. There's a lot of really heavy people, but, you know, a lot of times when you're disabled and, you know, she and I live on her fixed income. I've been disabled for many years, but, you know, I don't have disability. And they found out they're now making walking treadmills. And on a running treadmill, walking will actually tear it up because they're made to so now they're making walking treadmills. And I found one that was relatively inexpensive. And Dr. Rogers helped me get one. I'm going to be here in a few days. And I hope to I had dreams years ago that someday I'd run again. And I think it's going to happen. And but I discovered Protandim back in, well, I have a Cherokee friend here who whose wife had over the many years has had a very slow growing bone cancer. And she's taking this, and it's five herbs. It's all it is. It was developed by Dr. Joe McCord. He's a Memphis research scientist, and they started to market just a few years ago. And that Montel Williams has been on it for many years, and Donnie Osmond come out with his secret that, you know, so people are starting to catch on. And, but I, my Chickamauga friend, and he'll probably be listening to the show, but he, after a couple of months of his wife being on, you know, they were scanning her regularly, and they said that rather than very slowly progressing, that her cancer was beginning to recede, and they wanted to know what she was doing. And it's been, you can go to National Institute of Health, PubMed.org, and you can type in Protandim, PROTANDIM, and it helps any kind of cancer therapy, whether it's natural or radiation or whatever. But Dr. Rogers said he knew Dr. McCord, and he said as far as he was concerned, he uses a lot of the same herbs in his practice, the only 100% natural cancer clinic in the world. It's in Matamoros, Mexico, across from Brownsville. But he says it's the best disease preventative and that he knows of. And it changed my life. It took 4 days for that stuff to kick in. And I lost 13 pounds in 6 weeks and went to green corn. I could have done it last August without, and feel much, much better. It took about 27 days for Linda to feel it, and she's feeling much better. You know, after a couple months, you know, basically she couldn't get out and go shopping or anything. And, you know, by the fall, you know, she'd say, well, I'm going to go into town. And then she'd come back and start loading the groceries. So I said, Linda, what are you doing? You know, you're not supposed to be doing that. She said, oh, leave me alone. And, you know, she did it again today. She went out and you know, walked around. And now she's had a problem with her feet and what she thought were bone spurs, but it was plantar fasciitis. So she needed, you know, she has real thin feet, and she's had and so the doctor told her, just get some of those slip-on arch supports, and she did real well. And so, yeah, we're nursing ourselves back to health. And, of course, green corn ceremony is, when you go to that ceremony, I know my friend Joe Sitting Owl, his wife was real concerned about, you know, whether he was going to live, and because she'd lost, you know, one husband, and she started smelling death on Joe. And after ceremony, you know, he perked up and been in a lot better health. And so, yeah, we're kind of feeling our way through the mist here. I think Creator's going to keep me alive for a few more years here, and with the help of some good friends. And I've got a lot of people in the spirit world I'd like to see, but I'm not quite ready yet.
Well, that actually is I probably ought to say before people start calling me up that, you know, I don't take on any more clients or whatnot. I'm pretty much kind of retired now, you might say. So
yeah.
I just teach. And and what happened with me was that a couple of years ago, Spirit told me to stop doing long distance work, and I didn't understand it. I couldn't understand why, but whatever Spirit tells me to do something, I do it. And so even though I didn't understand it, I did. And now, and when I quit, everything kind of changed, and I started, you know, that's when I started doing more and more working in agriculture and with plants and so forth with the earth. And it all worked out in a very beautiful way. But what I understand now, looking back on it, is that I was spending so much time out of my body, you know, visioning and really for other people. I mean, I couldn't really, I didn't have enough time to do everybody, and so I was journeying a lot and whatnot, spending so much time out there that I wasn't enjoying life here on Earth. Like you say, we have plenty of friends who have gone on that we look forward to seeing, but I'm not ready yet to go see them.
I think that it's
part of that, you know, getting back, you know, putting my hands in the soil and in the earth and being one with Earth Mother here and present and alive and physical is very, very important. And so that's basically what I'm doing.
Yeah, Edgar Casey burned himself out and died young because of it, and so did Mad Bear Anderson. So you got to be careful.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the thing about Reiki Reiki teaches you not to absorb negative energy, but to send it outward along. And it's a built-in protection.
And to be grounded. It's very important to be grounded. To be grounded and centered. That's very important.
I
spend a lot of time now with the earth, with the soil, and enjoying the beings of the earth, both those you can see and those you can't see.
Well, Mark, I know you're going to have to ring off pretty soon. Is there anything you want to add before we wind this up in about 10 minutes?
Well, there was something that was coming to me, but I wasn't sure why, so I guess I'll just ask it for Jim. There is for some reason I was getting the idea that I should ask you about if you knew anything about things with like the chakras and people working. And I know your first book was clearing, it was a different kind of clearing, but something that would be clearing but for the body, for people's chakra energy systems and specifically the pineal. Is there something you know about that?
Well, there's several different ways that you can do a clearing. One of the things that that I teach is with the drum, and that is with your round drum. It's very simple to do. It's just tap on the drum on each, you know, start in your lap and then roll it. Just roll it up your body, just tapping on it. And it doesn't have to be touching your body. It can be just close to your body. And when you do that, you will actually hear the timbre of the drum change. And the reason for that is because the energy in your body is not in balance, okay? So what you do is, with the intent of relaxing and feeling that good earth energy coming through your body, allowing and releasing and letting go, letting things go that you don't need to have, and just kind of moving that drum up and down and tapping it. Just keep doing it until the tone, the timbre of it, is the same. And what you've just done is you've just cleared yourself using a drum.
Uh-huh.
Cool.
I'll bet you anything. Now, back in 95, after my first wife passed away, I married her best friend, and we moved to, a friend of mine bought a square mile in Utah in the desert and had a 400-foot tall piece of sandstone on it, and he built 5 homes back in that rock. And after at night, when all the electricity was turned off, you could hear, there was a lot of crystal in that red sandstone, and you could hear the vibration of Mother Earth. And Betty heard it, but I could hear volume differences. And we'd wake up in the morning and she'd hear it, and I'd say, you know, oh, is this the pitch? And she'd say, yeah. And I'll bet you anything that and of course, learning what I've learned about magnetic resonance, you know, from my friend Robert Three Eagles, who uses to build his own magnetometer, and he knows the frequencies of the resonant frequencies of all of the elements and how they change based on phases of the moon. And I'll bet you that drum is probably pretty, I bet it's somehow associated with, what is it, the Schumann frequency? And so all you're doing is just, you're literally tuning up your body using the resonance of Mother Earth. That's what I'm getting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I bet if you check the frequency, like on it, you'd have to get it in front of your drum in front of an oscilloscope, and then find out what gigahertz it's running at and what its harmonic resonances are. I'll bet one of those harmonics is the Schumann frequency, and which I understand is change. Isn't that changing, Mark?
Yeah, that's what I've heard. It's going up. It's been moving up from, I think, they've been saying like about 7.8 to towards 13.
Uh-huh. I'm pretty sure the frequency that's known by the Tibetan monks is the frequency. Because I remembered what I heard when I was in the rock and in the bedroom in there, and then I would hear, you know, listen to National Geographic and hear what the monks are intoning, and I'm pretty sure it was exactly the same. So,
yeah, I think that the guys at Bell Labs or something,
uh-huh,
I don't know, back in the 70s or something, when they were first doing things with, I guess, I don't know, cell phones or something, and they wound up having this background noise,
uh-huh,
hum. And they couldn't get rid of it. They figured out it was coming from everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And being their typical smart self, they just upped their amplified their own signal and just tried to drown it out. Was real smart.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so they it was probably the background resonant ohm of the universe, you know, the ohm,
yeah,
sound.
Right, exactly. I know that's probably the Tesla meter. At least my friend John James, who developed the Gas Mojo and the Intel Water. You can go on YouTube and put in Genie Water Wand, and he's, you know, developed a product that uses resonant frequency to get rid of anything that didn't belong in water, but it also disperses hydrocarbons, so they burn more frequently, and in your bloodstream, most people's red blood cells are agglutinated, and it disperses them using the magnetic field, and which allows them to have more inflation, and what you get minerals. Minerals is what causes your blood cells to move along and feed themselves and get rid of waste products and stuff like that. So, yeah, we're electric machines, and to work properly, we've got to be at the right pH, and we've got to have the right resonant frequencies, and we've got to be tuned up just like a car. And I know I had a friend back in the '60s. You know, they had a Jaguar XKE9. You know, every 6 weeks he was having to do a tune-up on that thing, and I think people need tune-ups on a regular basis too. So, Jim, what you're doing is you're doing the old physician heal thyself deal, teaching people how to become their own physicians and take care of their own bodies.
Right. That's what all my books are about. I feel that I've always felt like that if people kept coming back to me for help, then I wasn't doing something right. You know, that people, I teach, you know, all my books are about teaching people how to heal themselves and heal each other.
And yeah, you know, yeah.
I don't think, you know, I've heard it said, and I agree with it, that the age of the guru is over. And
yeah.
That if you follow, you know, the spirit within, or is in Cherokee, that that light, that spirit of light, the creator within, then you can heal yourself and others. And that's,
exactly.
That's the spirit behind all my books anyway.
Well, fantastic. Well, we really appreciate you coming on Prophecy Keepers Radio again. And
I'll try to be better about, you know, keeping in touch so it won't be 10 more years.
Oh, yeah. Anytime you feel you need to.
So, Jim, are you working on another book?
Well, I'm about halfway through one, but I'm not in any hurry to complete it.
Uh-huh. Well, can you give us any hints what it's about?
It's safely essays. It's just essays about various things, mostly about the earth and food, earth healing, and all the things that the usual suspects in my work.
Outstanding.
But hoping to bring people back to an appreciation of how interconnected we are, and that we're all children of earth and sky, that we all have divinity within us, that we have the ability to heal ourselves, heal our planet, and that if we are merely aware of that and have reverence for spirit and reverence for the earth and reverence for each other, that we can make this place heaven on earth.
Well, fantastic. And I'm going to go ahead and roll the outro music, and then we can chat for a couple minutes and before we let you go. But this has been another episode of Prophecy Keepers Radio, and if I had happy trails to you, I'd cue it up, but since I don't, here's the usual outro. Thanks for listening, folks.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases.
I'm Austin Powers. I like Gas Mojo. The very sexy, very switched on, yeah.
But you gotta have Gas Mojo, baby. Yeah!
What a gas, baby. Yeah!
I'm going to go back to the 60s and steal Austin Powers' Gas Mojo.
Hi, folks. This is Will Blueotter speaking on behalf of GasMojo.net Engine Booster. Immediate 25% fuel savings with GasMojo.net in just 5 minutes after installation. And your grandma can do it, so you just strap it on your fuel line, folks. Some customers report much greater savings. The GasMojo.net engine booster catalytically conditions any hydrocarbon fuel, be it gasoline, propane, diesel fuel. It's not a filter, it contains no metals, magnets, or toxic substances, and uses no electricity. The GasMojo.net engine booster unit is a specially designed tube containing a completely safe proprietary media. It's a passive fuel treatment process designed to disperse hydrocarbons for better performance and mileage, and also to break down carbon and other contaminants. Unlock your fuel's hidden energy potential now with GasMojo.net. And folks, you get a 100% money-back guarantee on this. I've got one on my car. It was developed by an old friend of mine, and he's an honorable person. You got to try it, folks, and go open a bank account now for all the money you're going to save. GasMojo.net, GasMojo.net. Just do it.
We can know your will. truth be